Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, and I am stoked tonight to have Nick White from Kansas on the phone here. And Nick and I shared a common tag this year, and so we're going to talk about his elk hunt and my elk hunt from Colorado. And start out. How are you doing, Nick?
Doing good tonight. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Sure thing, man. I appreciate you burning the time here. So back at the High Country shoot in June, I think is, if my memory serves me correctly, is when I first found out that you had a tag there for the same unit that I did there in Colorado. And I'd been putting in for, you know, a number of years, kind of building my points as a non-resident. And then when I moved to Colorado and became a resident, I didn't have enough points as a non-resident, and all of a sudden I had more than enough as a resident. So I decided to cash mine in this year, but why don't you, you know, as a non-resident, you had to burn substantially more than I did as a resident. So what did you have for points when you decided to cash yours in?
I had this year, I put in with 14 points. So basically this was my 15th year, you know, putting in to draw this tag. When I originally zeroed in on this unit, it took 6 or 7 points for a non-resident to draw. That's been
holy cow.
Several years. Well, it's been 15 years ago. I went out there with my boss just to go over the counter hunt, and I think I was 21 years old, and his dad was at that time a Colorado resident. He lived there close to Monta Vista, and he had drawn that tag. He was up there hunting. Well, on our way out there to just over the counter hunt, we get a phone call. Of course, this is before, you know, cell phones really. We got a call that he killed a good bull up in Treat area, and so we were pretty stoked about that. And it took us, you know, several hours to get up there. And we finally found his camp, which was a miracle in the dark, you know, never being in that country. The next morning, long story short, next morning, we helped him pack his bull out. And there was just bull screaming all around us. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is where I want. This is where I want to hunt, you know.
Yeah.
So started putting in for points, and then, you know, how that point creep works, you know.
Oh man,
seems like every other year it gets a little bit worse, and finally I caught up to it this year, and it couldn't have been a better, it couldn't have went down any better than I dreamed of it, you know.
Just yeah,
had some luck finally,
a
great hunt.
I actually stumbled into this unit in, I want to say it was 2011, 10 or 11, somewhere in there. I was hunting a different unit for deer and drove over the ridge into this unit. And it was a stark contrast from one side of the ridge to the other. I mean, I literally drove over the top of this ridge, went about a quarter mile down this dirt road, ended up throwing rocks at like a 180, 190 class non-typical mule deer that's bedded right off the side of the road in the willows, trying to get him to stand up so I could get better video of him. Then we drove about another quarter mile down the road, and from the road at like 10 o'clock in the morning, saw 6 bulls. And it was just like, holy cow. And I cataloged it back, you know, in the back of my mind back then. And always had it in mind that this is the unit that I wanted to hunt. And I mean, there are units in Colorado, certainly with bigger bulls. But it's hard to beat this unit for sheer bull numbers and, you know, decent quality as well. If you're happy with something that's in that 290 to, you know, 310 range, which I'm totally happy with all day long. What I need as a stick bow hunter is, you know, lots of opportunity, and you also shoot a recurve as well. So it's, you know, kind of same deal for you. It's like we need, you know, we need opportunities, not necessarily just 2 400-inch bulls in the unit to hunt. We need, you know, lots of opportunity, especially with the way the wind was cooperating where I was at.
Oh, the wind was brutal. For was it 3 or 4 days there? It was just inconsistent as could be. And it's just one of them deals. That's why you need, you know, you have to allot 10 to 12 days to hunt, because you know the weather's going to mess with you at least, you know, a third of that time.
Right.
And it sure, yeah.
So had you been back in this unit since that time when you first went in, when you helped that guy pack the bull out?
Yeah, I want to say that I have helped. Alvie drew the tag, and then my buddy Phil drew the tag. I helped him on a muzzleloader hunt, and then my uncle, Danny, he drew the tag in 2015, and my little brother and I helped him, and he shot a nice 5x5 that year. So I was, you know, well educated of the unit. I was a little concerned after I drew with the way they didn't have any moisture in the winter and spring and summer, and it was super dry. So, yeah, we definitely had some concerns there.
How did it contrast from, you know, I don't know how much time you spent helping your friends out there in maybe more normal precipitation or snowpack years, but how did that compare to this year, you know, once you got a chance to get out there and actually hunt it?
So in 2015, there was plentiful water everywhere above timberline. We saw, I want to say, quite a few more elk that year. But honestly, this year, the quality of bulls, we saw quite a few bigger, better bulls than we saw in 2015.
Interesting.
It was interesting. I can't explain it. And maybe that's just where I was, and maybe it just happened to be, you know, happenstance. But I don't know what the bull I ended up killing scored, but I saw probably 15 bulls better than him easily.
Wow. Yeah, that bull you shot is a heck of a nice bull, too.
Oh, I honestly had a goal of, you know, like you said, 290. That's a very... Mm-hmm. You know, that's a manageable goal in that unit. Hunting with a stick bow makes it a little harder, but I don't know what he scores. People tell me 310-ish, and I don't even care about the score. Mm-hmm. It was just a dream come true for me. But, I saw bulls. Probably the best bull I saw was 360, but I saw several 320 to 330 class bulls in there.
Yeah. That's pretty similar to what my experience was as far as from a quality standpoint. You know, lots of bulls in that 290 to 300 and some just edging over that 300 mark. I'm not a great judge of bulls myself, but that's kind of what the consensus amongst our group was when we were looking at them. And then we saw one that we figured was north of 350. Just a beautiful bomber 7x7 with, you know, long whale tails and the whole works. It was an awesome bull, but unfortunately, yeah, he didn't want to play.
No, so what I don't understand either is we were missing an age class of bulls, that 3 to 4 year old bulls, you know, the saddle bulls that, you know, come the second week, I was perfectly content with taking a bull of that caliber. Mm-hmm. We didn't see it. I think I saw maybe 2 bulls like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the straggler bulls that you can find out in the open bugling and you can call in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where they were. I don't know if they were with a giant herd of elk somewhere, but they sure weren't where we could find them.
Yeah, we saw more bulls that were in that 290 to 300 range than we did that were, you know, what I'd call a raghorn bull, you know, a 4 or 5 point. I think we saw maybe 8 raghorns, which I mean, when if you see eight bulls during, you know, a normal hunt, that's pretty stinking awesome. But we were seeing, you know, we were seeing that many in a morning.
You get pretty spoiled, and like you're saying in this unit, I mean, if you see eight bulls on a typical elk hunt, you had a great hunt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this unit, I'm seeing, you know, at least eight bulls a day,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I had a buddy from Canada that he flew himself. He's a great elk caller. He flew himself there to Durango, drove up, spent a week with me, and he's hunted Alberta for years, and he could not believe the way the elk hunt. He's like, you guys, you are so spoiled. I'm like, dude, this is the only time I've ever had this tag. I mean, I understand. I know this is a great unit.
Yeah.
Why I waited so long for it. But yeah, and then he had to turn around and leave on that Saturday, and he flew back. His dad was coming to Alberta, and he's like, it's not even, I don't even want to go back.
Oh,
it's
man.
It's not going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a friend of mine, Corey Beckendorf, from Utah. He's what hangs with the Team Backcountry guys there. And he did a similar thing. He drove out to, you know, from Utah, met me in Southern Colorado there. And he came and called for me. And what a godsend that was, man. He definitely saved the show for sure. I mean, so before we dive too far into the hunt, I guess, I mean, we're kind of filling in a little bit here and there, but why don't you give us some background as far as, did you come out and scout at all, or were you relying mostly on the previous years that you'd been out there helping your buddies? Or
we made a flying trip. I believe it was the first weekend of August. Between, you know, kids and other things, that was when I could go. And we drove out on a Friday, scouted Friday afternoon, Saturday, part of Sunday, and drove home. And basically, you know, we knew everything was going to change as far as the herds and where the elk were. We found elk. We were looking for water. That was our main concern, you know, to backpack hunt up there. And everywhere that we had found water in previous years, the streams weren't running, you know, they weren't coming out like mm-hmm. normal. And the ponds, you know, were pretty nasty, you know, and finally we did find it too. What it did is it pushed us further back. You know, we had to go further back, which was good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we got into some new country and bulls that, I don't think they'd been messed with back in there for a couple years, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was good. And even way back there, we were still drinking out of those high mountain rock lakes, you know.
Wow.
That's just the way it was up there. It was super dusty, super, you know, hot during the day. Your body didn't know what to think up there. I mean, you wake up and it's, your water was froze in your Camelback, and you wake up and hunt, and then, you know, by 10 o'clock, you're down to nothing. You know how that is, you know,
hunting
your mule deer. My ears, I see all your videos, you're wearing big hat to cover your ears. My ears are still scabbed from that. But we did go out and scout, found what we needed to see. I had three different places in mind I was going to hunt. One in particular, I really wanted to hunt. And, you know, honestly, when we went and scouted, I probably saw 400 elk.
Holy smokes.
In that weekend. And, it was insane, South. We left them alone. There was no reason to go near them. They were bedded down all over that high country tundra and just looked like polka dots.
Unreal.
I estimate it to be 300 to 400. Who knows? It was incredible. So I was like, well, they're here. You know, we don't have any reason to go anywhere else yet. So
yeah.
That was the plan from the get go.
Yeah, that's incredible, man. We didn't see elk in that kind of numbers. So I didn't do any scouting myself. I was going like a bat out of hell coming up to the season, and I had a Nevada mule deer tag, and I had a Colorado mule deer tag, and then of course this elk hunt. So I was kind of pushing it for vacation time or hunting time myself. So I just kind of figured, I was going to dive into the kind of the middle of the unit in a, you know, kind of similar neighborhood that you were in over there. And I, you know, based on what I had seen, whatever it was, 6-7 years or so ago when I drove into the unit, I had some decent ideas, and I talked to a few different people and gotten some intel from their previous hunts. And then right before I left, so I'd gotten home from my mule deer hunt in Colorado, and I had a week between then and when I left for my my elk hunt there, a guy reached out to me on Instagram that had been in there and had already filled his tag. And he's like, "Hey, I understand you have this, you know, tag, and I just got back from out of there. If you want some, you know, some of my insight on it, I'd be more than happy to share it with you." And so he gave me a few spots on the map, and I started looking at it and mulling it over the next couple of days. And it was kind of on the edge of the unit, and, you know, in an area I'm sure I would have overlooked. But the more I got to thinking about it, it's like, well, you know, more, I figured that there was going to be most of the hunting pressure, from, cause I was also going in during the, we were both in there during the muzzleloader season, but I was, you know, coming in right like the third day of muzzleloader. And so I figured, okay, we got all the bow hunters, and then we got all the muzzleloaders. So there's going to be more people in this unit, you know, when I, that 10 day period that I was going to be going, than at any point in time, during the bow season. And so I got to thinking, it's like, man, this area that he hunted, it's probably be a pretty smart approach, just because I think it's kind of, it was tucked away a bit, and I think it would be easily overlooked. So we decided to go in there with a plan B of going to my original kind of more centrally located area there. And, as it worked out, it was really good. I mean, we only packed in like 3 miles or something. So it was a breeze. We rolled up to the trailhead and got there, you know, before about an hour or so before dark, and then ended up finishing the last bit of our hike in the dark, and then got our camp set up. So we bumped into a few other hunters, but it wasn't too bad. How was the other hunting pressure for you guys where you were at?
So we saw a few hunters where we were at, but not really hunting, more on the trails, like, you know, okay, the trailheads or at a lake, you know, and visited with them. And it's just, to me, I didn't want to beat around the bush where I was going. And I was hoping they weren't beating around the bush. You tell me where you're going, I'll stay away from it. This is big country.
Yep.
There's plenty of room. There's not that many bow hunters, you know, allotted in here. And you were talking about muzzleloaders, and I never saw a muzzleloader hunter.
All right.
Not one. Yeah. So that was nice. And you know, you said you were 3 miles in, we were close to 10 where we hunted the first 5 to 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just, we didn't see anybody. We kind of, it was great. We had it to ourselves, and thank goodness, you know, the bull I shot wasn't 10 miles back in there. Cause
I didn't have a lot to pack.
I was envious of your llamas. I did see a guy up there that had a couple llamas.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the exact same color as an elk.
Oh no.
I was like, man, but he did have a big orange collar on that dude.
Yeah.
But you know, we saw them close to the trail, saw where they're hunting. I could tell where they were hunting. We just went on past it, went and set up camp and never had an issue with that. You know, there's a lot of acres out there.
Oh yeah. No, it's big country, man.
Yeah. And I, when we were back there, I knew where your second choice was. And I had looked at that, you know, cause I mean, I was within a couple miles of it. And I told my brothers, I said, so we're going to go back to base camp. My dad's coming out for a couple days. There wasn't a lot of elk around base camp when we first got here. And I told my dad, I said, you know, I'll come out, you know, I want you to come out and hang out with us. And that's actually a nice couple days for us to rest and sleep on a cot and eat some real food, you know, And so when we went back to camp, I mean, I was going to head back, you know, towards where you were, you know, thinking of going mm-hmm. to. That just looked so good and so huntable.
Yeah.
You know, the basins that we were hunting were not very wind conducive. You know, it was steep and nasty. That's why they liked it in there, you know, and the blowdown and,
mm-hmm.
but it was full of elk. But, anyway, so we ended up going after 6 days. We met my dad back at base camp and that was a refresher. You know, there was a nice big lake. We could take bath in that thing, and that cold water, I'm not sure what that temperature is, but oh, my man. Goodness.
Yeah. Oh. I dove in a lake earlier in the year, and I'm pretty sure that I bumped into some ice cubes, some icebergs when I dove in. It was the fastest U-turn I've ever made.
Yeah. We all did it. I mean, the hike back to base camp, it's a climb to get, mm-hmm. you know, that last half a mile, which is nice because you were hot and sweaty.
Right.
You didn't have to think twice.
Just
dumped your pack, clothes, and jumped in it. And boy, it takes your breath away, but it is refreshing. It makes you feel 100 times better.
Yeah. So why don't you kind of start from the beginning of the hunt and kind of give us some highlights there along the way and you know, as far as how the action was, if you guys got to call in any and et cetera.
We, like I said, we packed in, I got there on Saturday. I left here at 3 o'clock in the morning, picked up my brothers, got there around noon Colorado time. It took us several hours to get base camp, you know, up there. We ended up just eating supper that night, got our packs put together because we knew we were packing in 6 miles the next morning, and just kind of relaxed, acclimated a little bit. You know, we're 1500 feet where I live, so mm-hmm. I'm going from 1500 straight to 11.2, and then I'm climbing another almost 1500 the next day, and that usually messes with us for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did that. We got everything in, then hiked in the next day, and it was pretty brutal. The elevation caught up to my head, and I swear every step I felt it, you know. And got in, got our baby tent set up, and that evening we basically just kind of stayed up on the knife ridge. There was two basins we could watch from one ridge, which was really nice because actually my buddy also had a tag, and so he kind of watched one ridge and I watched another ridge, and the first night had not a big bull, a 3-year-old 5x5 was feeding with some cows, and I said, well, I needed a confidence boost, so I basically dove off into the basin and I had the wind in my face, and I snuck right in on him, and I got within 30 yards in no time of him. And I was like, okay, that's what I needed to know. You know, it's been a long time since I never had a great elk tag. And I just needed to know that I could get close, you know,
sure.
especially stick bow close. But that's a whole different hunt. And, did that. And my brother and his buddy saw what I was doing. So they dove off in and they knew I wasn't going to shoot the bull. And they came in with me first night. We messed with him, went, dove a little deeper into the basin, and I'm not kidding, South. There was 6 bulls over 300.
Holy smokes.
Down there. Yeah. And there was a good group of cows, about 25, but they were all together, and all these other bulls were just kind of messing around. You know, they were feeling froggy. It was that afternoon, showered, rolled through, you know, and it got them all on their feet. And Aaron said... Aaron bugled once and two or three of them responded immediately and kind of started filtering our way. So I just, once they got out of sight, I took off straight at him. We had the wind in our face and he called probably a 300 inch bull within 30 yards of me. And I was ready to take the shot. And he was down in the trees rubbing right below me and he never would give me a good shot. So, you know, that kind of happened. And then, you know, you come out of the, basically the first day of hunting with that going on, I'm like, man,
mm-hmm.
this isn't going to take long.
No, yeah.
and second, so that happened. We're all, you know, cranked up, eat some Mountain House meals and go to bed. The next morning we wake up, we're back on that ridge, and we kind of watch all the elk filter back into the timber. They were going to bed fairly early, and kind of stayed up on that knife ridge. And, you know, it was 9:30, 10 o'clock, and straight below us, I don't know if it was 500, 700, 800 feet down below us in the bottom. It was kind of like a little triangle where three creeks came together, and there was bulls. I could see bulls and wallers. They were just screaming back, and it was just social hour, you know, down there. Looked at my brother and Aaron, and I said, holy crap. I said, we're here to elk hunt. Mm-hmm. I said, let's go. We dove off into that thing, and it was steep getting down in there. And for whatever reason, the wind was constant that day. It never swirled once. It stayed in our face. We had the thermals, and I don't know if the wind was coming out of the east as well. And we got right in there, and bulls were bugling back at us. And I just, every time a bull would bugle, I'd move a little closer and a little closer. And then all of a sudden you realize, man, I'm close. And I turned back at Aaron. I said, I'm staying right here. I said, don't bugle again, just cow call. And he kept cow calling. And I look up in the trees, and you can see those big old horns, you know, swaying through the trees coming right at us. And I looked at my brother, and I made sure he saw him, and he's filming.
Mm-hmm.
And we got there, and I just got underneath a pine that actually hadn't, you know, been killed by the beetles. So I had some good shade, and I just stayed there. And I thought he was going to give me a 15-yard shot. Well, he comes right into about 30, 35 yards, and he's just standing there just bugling. And actually, my brother posted a video on Instagram yesterday of a bull bugling like 15 times. That was this bull.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he just over and over for 30 minutes.
No
way. He was right there, and he never would give me a shot. And I'm like, why isn't he coming down this trail? Well, I couldn't see that there was a giant dead tree in his way.
Oh.
I just couldn't. Matt knew it, and I couldn't see it. And so he turns, and he actually leaves. And I'm like, gosh, dang it. And it's just 35, 38 yards. That's farther than I want to shoot, you know. And he, finally, Aaron cow called a couple times, and he came back. And he's still quartering to me. I got nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, and I reined several times. And I'm like, if he turns broadside, that's my shot. He's not coming closer. And eventually he did. He turned broadside, and it was 31 yards. Well, I did my shot sequence, and I picked a spot, and the shot felt really good when I let it go. And not realizing how steep of an angle I was shooting, I hit the bull high.
Mm.
And I think I basically hit him, you know, right at that bottom part of his spine. It sounded like I hit his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still, you know, hopeful. You know, they came up to me, and they said, that looked good from where we were. And I was like, man, I don't know. I think it's too high. And watched the video several times, and we had a thunderstorm rolling in. And so we gave it about 45 minutes and took on the trail, and we were able to follow his tracks really good. I mean, he was just bowling stuff over, and ended up finding my arrow. We tracked him about, I don't know, a quarter mile to, and I didn't get hardly any penetration. Like I said, I just hit him high. Well, I didn't realize how steep. I put a piece of toilet paper where I was standing, went down to where he was standing, and I looked back up, and I'm like, holy cow. So it didn't look steep, you know, in that dark timber. It just, you don't have very good depth, you know? So yeah. I was pretty bummed about that on second day, you know, but we spent the rest of the day looking for him, and I was convinced that he's was absolutely fine, you know. So
yeah, those things are so tough.
Yes. Yeah. It's amazing how strong those animals are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, watching him, I mean, he was just running over stuff, and I think it hit him right there in that hard spot of the spine, and he didn't know what the heck happened. But I'm sure he's absolutely fine.
Yep. Yep.
Still running. I'm down. So. But it's never a good feeling. I mean, every bow hunter goes, you know. So we trudged on, you know, and just kind of licked our wounds and kept after it. And that was day two. So day three and four, I had a couple other close encounters. made a heck of a stock in that other basin I was talking about. There was one bull that was stayed way high in the basin. Every morning they'd be up there high feeding in those willows, and he stayed high, and the cows left. There was another really good bull in there, and he left. And Scott said, "Man, I don't know if you can get down in that thing without him seeing you. You know, you're just no cover." And I said, "Well, here's my pack. All I can do is try." And I just got on my back and just started sliding down there, and I was able to make a great stalk. And I got within 14 yards of that bull.
Holy smokes!
And never could get a shot. I never could get a shot. He just, and the wind was west southwest. Up on top of that Jack Ridge. And mm-hmm. when I got down in the bottom, it was exactly the opposite. I knew I only had a matter of minutes, you know, to make it happen. And the wind eventually got me. The only shot I had of him was, you know, behind the rib cage, and I wasn't going to take that shot.
Right.
That's how you dream of shooting a big old bull like that, you know, just slipping in on him without him knowing.
Yep.
But that didn't work. And then after that, the next several days, it got tougher. That was that point when it got super windy and hot, you know, and they were, you had a small window in the morning. You saw elk, but they were transitioning to their bedrooms quick, mm-hmm. you know, and into the trees. And then same thing in the evening, they just weren't moving very good. And I'm pretty sure that's about the time where you and I were, you know, talking in the evenings,
yeah,
trying to figure out what we were going to, how you're going to make it happen, you know?
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. From my end, I'll jump in. So we rolled in, to camp. We got there just after dark at that first night, and so we're setting camp up and, you know, everyone's getting ready to turn in. And then so we're camped up on top of a ridge at right at 12,000 feet. And on the map, I'd located some springs that were showing on the map that were in the canyon right below us. And on the ridge on the far side of, you know, of those meadows down there in the bottom on the other side of the canyon from our camp, we could hear bulls bugling that night. And it's like, oh man, there's nothing like, you know, getting into them right out the gate. So we knew our morning plan, before we went to bed that night. Well, we had already anticipated going down in there, but now it was solidified. So that first morning we dropped down in the canyon and we bumped a bull on our side in the timber right at the edge of the meadow when we hit the bottom. And we never got to see him, but it was a, you know, real deep growler for a bugle. So I was really bummed when we bumped him because I felt like that was a, you know, really good bull. And across across this meadow in the bottom, you know, across the bottom of the canyon on the ridge on the other side, there must have been a hot cow or something, because there were just a pile of bulls. There was probably five bulls, maybe six bulls that were right in this one small area. It was really strange. So I felt like, you know, after I'd hunted there my entire hunt, I felt like the bull to cow ratio where we were at was about 1 to 1, or maybe at the most 1 bull to 1.5 cows. I mean, there were, we saw virtually as many bulls as we did cows, and we saw, bulls by themselves. We saw like bachelor groups of bulls, 3 or 4 or 5 bulls together. Which at this time of year just was a total head scratcher. And then we only saw 2 bulls that had harems that were, you know, more than 6 or 8 cows, and none more than 10. It was really interesting. And you would think that under those kind of conditions, all you'd need to do is blow a cow call and you'd get stampeded by bulls coming in, right? But it seemed like if a bull had a cow, he was reluctant to come in to another cow call, figuring that that cow had to already been hooked up with another bull, and he didn't want to take the chance of losing his cow to, you know, another bull. So he was going to play it conservative and not, you know, they'd just shut up. I mean, they'd be screaming, you know, regularly bugling, and then you'd sneak in on them. You'd set up, you know, 80 to 100 yards away from them, cow call, and they'd go shut. They'd just go quiet. And it was so frustrating. We were having such a devil of a time trying to figure out how to work these things. And then where we were hunting, the wind was so erratic. In the morning, you'd have, you know, maybe an hour and a half where the wind would be blowing downhill or be blowing in one direction, at least fairly consistently. And then the rest of the day was a crapshoot. It would literally be blowing from all four points on the compass at any given minute. It was just constantly shifting. And I could tell you just the first 4 days were stories of us just blowing out bulls is basically what it was. You know, hiking a lot and finding elk, dropping in and then spooking everything and then climbing back out of the canyon and then, you know, going and then finding more bulls and then spooking them. And it was getting super frustrating. And we had been communicating back and forth, you know, on how your hunt was going over there, how many cows you're seeing, you know, and we were trying to kind of make an educated decision on, geez, do we, you know, stick it out here or do we pull up? Because invariably you end up losing, you know, at least either a morning or an evening hunt if you're going to pull up and move camp. And so we fast forward to day five for me. We had decided the night before that we were going to pull out and move up in your direction. And so we actually got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, tore down camp in, you know, in the dark, weighed out all the llama panniers. Basically, we were planning on doing a quick morning hunt. And then, we were going to, you know, pack out, hit the truck, drive around to the middle part of the unit and then pack into another area. And so that night, you know, we had pretty well boogered up the basin below our camp. I think we'd already been into it twice and blown elk out both times. And, so we hunted that one the first day, the second day, we rested it the third day and the fourth day. And by that, the evening of the fourth day, the elk had come back in there. And so we were hearing, a bugle that night on the far side of the canyon again. So we, the next morning we dropped in there, and in the first, like as soon as we hit the bottom, and it's probably a good 300 yards of meadow getting across the bottom of the canyon with some little fingers of timber, you know, interspersed in there. But for the most part, it's fairly open. So we hit the bottom of the timber where it meets the meadow in the bottom, immediately blew out two bulls that were, that had been quiet up to that point. And they were just on the edge of the timber and we didn't see them. And so I was pretty bummed. You know, I wasn't sure. There was another bull that was still bugling on the ridge across from us. Blew out one bull. We blew out one bull there at the bottom. So then we crossed that, you know, the big open meadow in the bottom. And this is, you know, just shortly after first light, we started bombing off the hill before it was just kind of getting gray light. Got to the far side of almost to the far side of the meadow, blew out two more bulls that were, you know, just at the edge of the timber. So we had blown out three bulls in like less than half an hour. And there's one more bull that's up there on the ridge. And it's just like, I was so dejected at that point. It's like all, you know, for 5 days now, all we had been doing is spooking bulls, it seemed like. And so it's like, well, what the heck, you know, let's go up there and spook this guy too. Don't want to leave a stone unturned, right? So he was about 200 vertical feet above us. So, now we're getting into the timber and all the blowdowns and this, and we're hoofing it as fast as we can because this bull is fairly hot. He's bugling. Except for when we spooked the two bulls that were, you know, down below him, he had been bugling fairly regularly. And so he shut up when we blew out those two bulls. but it only took him about 10 minutes to get fired back up again. And then he was bugling again. So we had a good pinpoint on his location. So we started climbing up the ridge and we got, it was, you know, fairly steep going. And then, we kind of hit a little bit of a bench and then there was another bench above us. And then it, climbed a little bit higher and it was kind of like a little bit of a knoll where, not really a knoll, it was more of a bench, I guess, where that bull was. So at this point, we're, you know, maybe 100, 150 yards below him probably. And Nick, one of my camera guys, he's like, ah, dude, let's just call from here. And I was like, man, I want to get in as tight as we can. I wanted to get in to make him feel threatened because we had been having problems with them just clamming up. And so I figured, you know, get in as close as we can and we got a better chance of making something happen. So we went ahead and we climbed up the steep little incline and then we hit the top of the next bench. And so I had Corey and my cameraman, JV, one of my employees here. Those two went over to the kind of the edge where it dropped off back to the bench that we had just come up off of. And so at that point, they're about probably 75 yards or so from the bull up on the next kind of benchy knoll above us. And, so I kind of snuck around a little bit, kind of circling a little bit to keep, you know, to get further out into the wind there so that that bull would have less of a chance of coming in and catching my scent. Because there was a relatively open kind of corridor, if you will, that went somewhat from where the bull was down to where Corey was. And we had one of those Wayne Carlton decoys, that three-dimensional plastic cow face that stuck onto a silhouette of a cow there, or a frontal silhouette of a cow. And, so Corey had gotten set up. I moved up the hill away. So at this point, I'm about 50 yards from the bull and I'm about 40 yards from Corey. And Nick, is about 7 or 8 yards behind me. So I had him kind of tucked back into they may have been burnt. They're dead, some dead pines. They're just kind of basically some snags. And, then I gave the signal to Corey to start calling. And so he cow called, a few times and that bull just went nuts and started tearing up. Oh, so I snuck up to the point. So 50 yards, I could see the top of the bull's antlers over this pine tree. And once Corey started cow calling, man, that thing went nuts and started just tearing this pine tree up. And, when he started doing that, I took my backpack and slipped out of my backpack, set it on the ground. And I was like, man, if he's going to keep this up, I'm just going to sneak in there and try and get an arrow in him. Well, about the time I got my backpack off and he stopped raking and then took one step towards me in my direction. And at that moment, Corey started raking a dead branch. On one of those dead snags there. And I was like, no, thinking in my head, no, you know, cause the bull had just like committed to starting to come in. And I thought, oh man, you know, I don't want to spook this guy off with the presence of another bull. And, but when he started raking, that cow or that bull just committed and he just started coming in. Well, I had stepped down onto this little game trail. And when I stepped down kind of backwards to get more level footing while he was raking on that tree and I was taking my pack off, it ended up putting a kind of a dead, like beetle kill pine tree directly between me and the bull. So that bull starts coming in and he's got his head down, you know, direct frontal, and he's walking straight at me. And so as soon as I saw he was coming, I went ahead and drew my bow. And the bull's, you know, way out of range at this point. And he's, no shot angle. But I knew the closer he got, the harder it was going to be for me to draw my bow without blowing him out. So I was just like, well, hopefully he doesn't hang up and, you know, I can get a shot at him. And I'm going to be able, and hopefully I can keep it back at full draw. But I figured it'd be better for me to be at full draw and then have to let down if I needed to, rather than to try to draw if he's super close. And thank goodness I did that, because he just kept right on coming, and he was like walking on a string right towards me. And at about 7 or 8 yards, he rips this bugle and then turns at a slight angle and starts coming across in front of me, but he hasn't cleared that pine yet. And I'm not going to get a shot until this thing is like practically on top of me. And at one point, I actually thought he was going to walk right over me. But he keeps coming. And I'm kind of slowly swinging on him as he's coming. And then kind of line up for a shot as he steps out from behind that dead snag that's literally like 4 or 5 feet in front of me. I mean, that thing is right there. And as he's coming closer, I started tripping. I was like, man, that thing is huge, the body on him, because I'm starting to look. It's like, okay, where I need to pick my spot, right? And then I start tripping out on the muscles in the shoulder. You can see all the definition of the muscles through his hair and hide. And he steps out, just clears that dead snag there. And as he did, it seemed like he was starting to, because I moved just slightly to get my shot lined up, and it seemed like, in my recollection and watching the video, that he moved, just started to pivot his head just as I shot. And I mean, I'm literally like 5 or 6 feet from this bull when I shot him. And fortunately, he jumps the other direction, because that was the other thing. It's like, man, I sure hope he doesn't lower his antlers when he sees me or when I shoot him. And fortunately, he jumps, runs up on top of up over the top of that little knoll, back over the bench, where not in the direction he had come, but back up over the top. And so I was just like, I was beside myself, man. I just couldn't believe what had happened. And I turned to Nick, and I dropped my bow down, took my hat off. I had that boonie hat on, set it on my bow, or dropped it on top of my bow. And I was just like going, holy cow, can you believe what just happened like this? And all of a sudden we hear pop, crack, pop, crack, pop. And I look back over to where Corey's at, and Corey turns around, and here comes a bull coming in to the cow calls. And I'm just like, oh my goodness. And then my bow's sitting there on the ground. I reach down there. I pick my bow up, but the string from my boonie hat's wrapped around my arrow clip. So I can't get an arrow. I'm trying to pull an arrow out. And I'm like, wait a minute, you dummy. You just shot a bull. You can't do anything here. And so that bull literally walks within 10 feet of Corey, and then stops directly between me and Corey. And he's quartering hard into me. And Nick is facing me, so the bull's coming in at his back. And so he's got his DSLR on a monopod, so he literally just spins the camera 180 degrees, and he's filming back over his shoulder at the bull. And I'm tripping, looking at this bull's going, and I was like, man, I hope my bull's that big. As I'm thinking, as I'm looking at him, I'm like, man, that thing is ginormous. And then I look between the bull's legs, and Corey is like on his knees giving me the double thumbs up, and he's got this ear to ear grin. It's just like, dude, this is the coolest thing ever. Right. And, I don't know. I didn't realize this, because the bull's quartering into me and I can't see his side, but Corey can see my broadhead and my arrow sticking out, from the bull on his side. So I had shot him tight right behind the shoulder. So from my angle, I can't see my broadhead hole. And so I'm sitting here looking at this bull, thinking it's a completely different bull the whole time. Corey's looking at him going, please don't shoot him again. Cause you know, he's right in the line of fire. Right. And so finally, after, I don't know, maybe 20 seconds or so, the bull turns. And then I saw my hole in a side there. So I grabbed out an arrow real quick and knock it. And then, the bull walks about 10 yards at a fast walk, and then, stops behind a big pine. Of course, it's blocking his entire vitals. I can see his butt and his guts, and I can see like his nose, and that's it. And So the bull's at maybe 20 to 25 yards from me at this point. And so I've got my bow ready, you know, holding it up there just in case when he steps out, I can get a shot. I only got a window of about 2 feet before he drops off the steep hill there and then drops down to the next bench. So the bull's just standing there and then finally starts moving, and I just, you know, drew back and snapshot, and unfortunately shot right underneath him, when he went through that little opening. So the bull dives off, crashes down, you know, we hear him run off down the hill, and he ended up going about maybe another 100 yards, 125 yards, something like that. I mean, this bull, I can't believe how stinking tough they are. I hit him about 3 or 4 inches above the point of the elbow, tight behind the shoulder, and exited like 2 ribs back from the back on the far side, and got the near lung, got the big part of the lobe on the back lung, on the far lung, and then got the liver. And this guy was probably, he was probably only alive really for 2 minutes, but still, I can't believe that he was even alive for that long. Really surprising. And then the amount of ground he covered in total was probably 150 yards. I know 175 yards would be my guess. Maybe it wasn't quite that far. I know because of the high entrance and higher exit, it didn't leave much blood on the ground at all. And so it really gave us some fits, blood trailing them. It took us over an hour to recover them. Meanwhile, you know, I was like, you know, worst case scenario, I know I got one lung and liver. Best case scenario, I got the back end of the far lung. And so we decided, okay, we're just going to go back to camp, dump all our stuff out of our packs, get the llamas, bring them down to the bottom, and then go, you know, butcher them and then pack, because there was just too many blowdowns to be able to get the llamas in there. So we figured we'd, you know, butcher them, pack the stuff to the bottom of the canyon there, and then be able to use the llamas to haul them up. And that's what we ended up doing. It worked out pretty slick. But it's pretty funny that, you know, we were looking at relocating, and, you know, and then that morning, you know, in the clutch, we managed to fill our tags there, or my tag.
Do you think that has anything to do with the, you know, going into that morning, you knew you were done there, and do you think you just went harder at it? Like, you didn't care anymore if you boogered this up, or we're going, like, we're leaving regardless?
No, you know, we dropped into a canyon the day before, and we had glassed up from the top. We had glassed up 9 bulls and then heard another one in the dark timber directly below us that we couldn't identify as far as visually. So we knew that there was at least 10 bulls in this canyon, and we dropped in there, and I'm pretty certain we blew out every single one of those. And I mean, we were hunting our butts off as far as hiking. We were covering a lot of ground. And if a bull made a sound, we were going after him. It didn't matter, you know, how deep the canyon was between us. I think it was just a matter of, we got on that bull early when the wind was good, and we weren't getting screwed by the wind like we had been on most of the other approaches that we had taken. Because most of the other bulls, I think we only got on, we got on one bull in the evening that the wind had cooperated or was cooperating. But I was going in and the bull was coming to me, and we, you know, bumped into each other, one of those deals. And then the first morning, actually on that same side hill that I ended up killing my bull, we got on another one that just got, you know, got suspicious. We hadn't employed the decoy yet. And I think had we have used the decoy, maybe there would have been because we called that one into, I don't know, probably 50 or maybe 60 yards at the outside. But I think it was just mostly a matter of just getting, finally getting a break with the wind.
Yeah. 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 You know, you're talking about boogering elk like that and bumping them out of those basins like that. So, we were hunting those two basins, and my buddy, he had one up in the afternoon plan is I'm going to go after these. I'm going to wait for the wind to switch and I'm going to dive in. I said, okay, well, I'm going to go over here and, you know, and hunt this side. And so I was set up where I was, you know, in my ambush spot, waiting for him to come out. And I look up on the ridge and I told Matt, I said, look, I said, there's cow coming over the top of that. And I said, he must have went in there. Mm-hmm. I think here comes a whole bunch of elk. And there was 10 cows and one bull came over the top. They dived down into the trees and I kind of watched them. And then I watched them bed down. They didn't bed down 100 yards from the ridge. They went down in them trees. Huh. And I'm like, that's interesting. It wasn't 2 hours later, they go right back over the top, right back where they were.
No kidding.
All of them. Yep. Yep. So you wonder when you blow elk out, you know, how far are they going? You know, where are they? Are they leaving the county?
Right.
Or are they just popping the ridge? And that was pretty interesting to watch that, you know. And then I told Phil that night, I said, they went right back in there. He said, they did? I said, yeah. I said, I watched every one of them go right back over the same trail they came in when you boogered them.
Yeah.
So pretty neat. I know, back to your bull. Yeah, man, I was, you sent me that picture of your bull that night. That was like a huge spiritual lift for me. I was like, man, you know, cause it's physically exhausting, mm-hmm. but more so to us, it was mentally exhausting. Just trying to figure out how you're going to get it done when you're not committing to calls and you've got, you know, essentially 3 to 4 people in a group and the wind is terrible. And it's just, you're like, you know, there's a lot of pressure on your shoulders to get it done, especially when you have a camera crew right behind you, you know?
And, is that, and then, you know, you had 14, 15 years of putting in on it and I had, you know, 11, and to know that I'm not going to get to go do this again next year. It definitely, it puts a lot of pressure on you for sure. And yeah, like you say, you add cameras in there and guys taking vacation time and all that. It's a tremendous amount of pressure. No doubt about it.
Like you said, 15 years of buildup and then, you know, all from the second, I think, well, I knew June 5th was the day that I found out I drew that unit. I suspected I was going to draw it, but June 5th was the day I was sitting at the breakfast table before work. And I remember that because that was my birthday.
I looked
at my email. I saw my email. I saw the deal from CDOW and I started started shaking. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't even want to open it. I said, too many years I've opened it and I've got the unsuccessful, you know, and I opened it and I saw successful and I just like, from that moment on, you knew the summer was going to be preparation for this hunt,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the wife is great, you know, about, she understands, she knows what I am. She married it, you know, she knows when I get something in my head like that, it's no holds bar, you know, and she put up with it all summer and was great about it, you know, and anything, you know, it's a ton of work to prepare for something like that before you even leave the house.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get there and then my brother, you know, with Rockhouse, he had just come from a 2.5 week stint in Alberta filming a sheep hunt and, you know, nasty, horrible wet. His hands were rotting. It was so
wet.
Goodness. And he came home one day and he left with me to come out hunting, you know, because sacrifices like that people are making, you know, to go and help. And then my other brother, you know, he took off 10 to 12 days, you know, leaving. He just had a baby. He's got 3 kids and all this is weighing on your mind, you know, mm-hmm. I got to get this done. And then to make things more difficult, I'm hunting with a stick bow.
Right. You know? Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, bow hunting elk is hard enough. And then you add that into it. And, I know when my deal finally went down, I was just a huge monkey off my back, you know, and mm-hmm. just.
Yeah, absolutely.
So.
Mine was, yeah, I mean, you got to watch yours. Well, I'm not going to do a spoiler here. So we'll get you to tell you the rest of the story, but mine was almost like more anxiety because I shot this bull and then I had all the second the second guesses on the shot, and I knew it was a dead bull. I mean, I knew with the way that arrow went that it was a dead bull, but as we were blood trailing this thing and we're just not finding, you were finding a speck of blood here, a drip of blood here, a little wipe here. And I mean, it was extremely challenging. We're finding a footprint here and I'm just like, man, my heart's sinking. And even as we're walking up, you know, before we started on the blood trail, we followed maybe 30 yards before we went back up to camp. And so I had a little bit of an idea what we had in front of us as far as from how scant it was. But I mean, just the anxiety and worry and all that, I was excited, but at the same time, just totally anxious. And that feeling, man, because it was like 4 hours by the time we got back with the llamas and then got back on the blood trail again. So that whole time, I've got this conflicting emotion of not knowing, you know, is my bull dead? Am I going to recover this thing? Am I not going to recover it? You know, did I just blow an awesome opportunity? And man, when we got, it was pretty funny actually. Corey pulled one of these bad tricks on me where, you know, we're all, you know, hands and knees and we're looking for blood. And I just found a spot and Corey was kind of doing a little bit of a sweep ahead of me and looking for it. And then he starts doing the, you know, the finger motion in a circle like this. And I wasn't really paying that close attention to what he was doing, but he's motioning to Nick and to JV. And he's like, "Hey, I found some more blood." And he's like, "Come here, South. I found some more blood." And I was like, "All right." So I jump up and I walk over to where he's at. And he's like, he points down the hill and I see an antler sticking up, but it's not computing. Cause I'm looking for blood. I'm not looking for an antler. And why is he pointing way down the hill when I'm looking for blood at my feet? And it was like this, like 3 or 4 seconds where I couldn't put those two, that image together with what I was expecting to see. And then I was like, "Oh, no way." And man, I was so relieved, so much relief and so much like, just like you let the air out of a balloon as far as the anxiety dissipating. It was a pretty incredible experience. Just that 4 hours of that roller coaster of emotion and not knowing, you know, what the outcome is going to be.
That's not even a very good joke. I've had that happen, you know, hunting whitetails or whatever, you know, people, that's no time to joke.
Right.
Yeah. Once it's over, after. And I know, you know, the anxiety you're going through, you know, it is super hard to blood trail when it's your own blood trail.
Yep.
You know, your mind's not right. You know, it's going 100 mile an hour. You need somebody there that's not quite as vested.
Right. 100%.
Clearly. You know? Yeah. Yeah. So that's incredible. You had posted that picture of, you know, you at 6 feet shooting that bull. And I saw that, you know, we at base camp, we had decent service some days. It was weird. We had decent service. And then other days I had nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing, not a bar. And I was in my cot and I seen that picture and I showed it to Scott. I said, "Look, I said, this can happen." we got to keep going. You know, it was lifting, you know, to see that it can go down like that. No, I didn't get to shoot mine near that close. I would have taken that, but yeah. That was pretty incredible. So mine, it was the, I think it was the 9th day of hunting. And I knew my brothers were going to go home with my dad in a couple days. And I really wanted them to be there when it went down, you know, it just meant, you know, it was going to mean that much more. And we had made plans also, like you, I said, this is it. I feel like we've ran these elk ragged here in this area. I think I need to move. You know, I was getting reports of some great, you know, action going on in another area. And I was like, we're going at this day. Like, this is the last day I'm hunting here. You know, if we find a group, we're going 100 mile an hour. So we take off up the trail, and we've been leaving camp, I think, too early, you know, and I think we were, like you said, you were bumping into elk, you know, before you could even see very good.
Yeah.
And I said, let's sit here at camp. Let's get up, eat breakfast, drink some coffee. I said, let's sit here 20 to 30 more minutes and then take off. I said, cause we always say we're going to go slow and we're going to do this. And I know me and my brothers, we get going and we don't do anything slow,
right?
You know? And so we got up there to a little glassing point, and Scott hit the bugle and immediately got one. And the night before that, there was several good bulls in an area. I actually glassed another ridge the night before. They took my dad to this ridge and glassed, and they were pretty confident we were going to get into them that morning. And sure enough, we did. We found my bull, and there was four cows with him. And we saw where he was. He had a 50-50 chance he was going to go one way or another. And I said, we've got the wind this direction. Just do what the wind tells you. So we jumped the ridge over and just hauled butt and got clear around him and got, you know, in the mix in the trees there. And Scott started bugling a couple times, and he was responding to us. And then all of a sudden, another bull straight on top of us, way above timberline, was just going off. So where we ended up going was a bench right at timberline that they take around the north side, and then they'd go bed on that north face. I had actually, in the summer when I went out scouted, I had put up a couple trail cameras, and one of my trail cameras was right here on this bench. Huh. I'm not thinking about this at all during this hunt. Uh-huh. I'm hunting, you know, and we get in there, I get around, my brothers follow me, you know, Matt's filming, Scott's calling a little bit. We took a heads up decoy with us that morning. We needed that edge, like you, something to just bring them on the rest of the way, you know. And we got in the middle of this deal. We actually bumped a smaller bull, and I said, piss on him, let's go. And we got there, and I got on the edge, and there was two trails on this bench right above timberline. One was 15 yards, one was 27 yards. And my first place I sat down, I was too close to that first trail. And, you know, Matt's trying to film over my shoulder from about 20 yards behind with his SLR. And I moved a couple times, and he's like, God dang it, sit still. And I'm like, I got to find a spot. This will work. And finally I found a spot, you know, and all of a sudden the bull that I ended up killing was getting closer. And I'm like, he's within 100 yards, dude. And I looked back at Scott, and Scott had been using his bugle tube a few times, and he had both these bulls worked up. And when he got within 100 yards, I looked at Scott and I gave him the no more. You don't need to call again. I said, these guys are talking to each other. We're right in the middle of it. I said, they don't need to know where we're at. We're on this bench. If he comes through here, he has to come by me. So he comes out, and I'm not even thinking about that stupid trail camera. And it's an email camera, and my uncle and Cheryl on it. He comes out into the trees, and he looks up south, and you know how them bulls talk to each other. I mean, they literally have a language, and they're, you know, they know what each other are saying to each other. He comes out of the tree about 100 yards from me, looks up the hill at that other bull. I can't see the other bull, but he's within 200 yards of me. He's right up on top, and he just screaming at that bull, and it was literally like he was saying, get your ass down here, you know? I mean, that's what he said, And he looks back, and he looks back into the trees, and he goes back into the trees, and I was like, no, going. And so I'm on my knees, so I stand up real slow, and I'm looking for my brothers, because I'm thinking, shit, he's going to take this bench behind me, and I'm looking for Matt and Scott, and I can't see him, and I'm like, I can't shoot that way, I don't know where those two are at, you know, and all of a sudden I realize what the bull's doing. He's going back and getting those cows, and he pushes the cows right out. And so the cows come by me on the 15 yard trail, and I'm hidden, you know, I've got my Sitka hoodie on with the little ninja mask, you know, I'd pulled that over just for concealment. And these cows come by me, and they're not nervous, but they're looking, you know, in my direction, and my bow's shaking like crazy. And I'm like, I hope they don't see that. And, uh, and, And finally, here he's coming. And then, you know, and this is the point where everything is boiling down. I'm like, my brothers are wore out. They've got to go home. They've stuck it out with me this long, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The only screwing this up, the wind is in my face, everything's, I said, the only thing that's screwing this up is me.
Yeah.
And I said, you just do the thing, you know. And he ended up taking that farther trail, which was 27 yards. And I, you know, I didn't want to shoot that far, but it's a big animal,
yeah,
you know. And
yeah,
and we shot the high country shoot, you know, and we shot targets, several targets farther than that. You practice, yeah, for, you know, way farther than that all summer. And the cows meander by, he's coming, you know, I went through my shot process and I'm swinging on him, which I don't really care to do, you know, to shoot like that.
Yeah.
And he comes, and I have two lanes, and I mute at him twice, and he stopped and picked that spot, you know, and let her, you know, let him have it. And it just, I mean, that arrow went exactly the hair I was looking at.
Oh, nice.
And it actually, his front leg was, it wasn't back, but it was like, you know, right in line, maybe a bump back.
Yeah.
And the arrow, the broadhead actually blew through the shoulder blade, you know, at 27 yards. And, so I shoot him, and you know how you talk about the anxiety, and, you know, immediately you're like doubting yourself. And I'm watching the bull, and he runs up onto the scree on the edge of that ridge there. And, I'm guy, my binoculars are up, and I'm watching him. They're all fogged up, and he runs up there, and he didn't know what happened, you know, and he's looking around, and I'm like, can I get enough penetration? There was about a foot of the arrow sticking out, and which is gobs plenty, you know, penetration. Yep. And he runs up there, and like you said, those things are tough. I mean, he stood it out. He was done in less than a minute, but it seems like forever, you know.
Yep.
You know, when he runs up there, his rear end started getting a little crazy, and he tipped and started falling down those rocks. And about that time, my legs just went numb, and I just fell to my butt, you know. And and you're like, did that just happen?
Yep, yep.
And, my brothers come running up and freaking gang tackled me, you know. And we just sat there for a few minutes, you know, didn't even walk over to him, you know, for a while, and just kind of took in the moment.
Yeah,
you know? And it was so nice to just watch him fall and, you know, and to have some closure right away, you know, rather than like your deal,
right,
you had to wait 3-4 hours, you know, before you got that, you know. And
yep.
And went up to him and on it, I'll be straight up honest. I lost it. I never had I don't know if it was the adrenaline or the 15-year anticipation or what it was, but I just teared up. It was nuts. I'd never had an animal do that to me, but
the culmination,
pretty special moment.
Yeah. The culmination, yeah, of all that, yeah, you know, the pressure, like we were talking about, you know, with the, you know, feeling responsible for everyone taking all that time off. Everyone else, you know, is, you're tired from humping those hills, but then you have it, you know, also knowing that everyone else in the party is doing that same effort that you're putting in, and they don't even have the tag in their pocket. And yeah, it's like, it's a lot to, you know, to set on your shoulders and really to absorb, and somebody who, you know, doesn't care about their buddies or whatever. Yeah. They may not think about it or whatever, but any, you know, pretty much anyone I know, all that weighs on their mind, you know, when you're up there and everyone else is sacrificing to help you out. And, yeah, it's a lot.
And it's a huge sacrifice. I mean, when you don't have the tag in your pocket, and you're hunting your butt off, I mean, you are putting 8 to 10 miles of hard mountain miles a day, mm-hmm, on.
Yeah.
You're eating like crap. You're sleeping like crap, you know, and then you get to get up at 4:30 in the morning and do it again. And that's tough to climb out of bed when it's not your gig.
Right.
You know, you can't thank them enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, cause that elk hunting is a team sport. I learned that more this year than I ever knew. I mean,
yeah,
there's a lot of guys that go out and do it themselves, and I mean, they're animals, because it's tough. And I love that it's a team sport.
Right.
I think that's part of why I broke down. Usually when I kill an animal, I am totally by myself.
Sure.
You know, and that deal, you know, everyone was there and my brothers were worked up. I mean, the film, my brother filmed it, and I think he was breathing and shaking harder than I was, you know. He said the adrenaline was so bad, he couldn't hardly stand up. His back muscles were tight, and it was time. I mean, it was time that it went down.
Yeah.
And thanks to the good Lord, he let me make a good shot, and it happened that way.
Yeah. So, no, it's pretty stinking awesome when it all comes together like it's, you know, like we envision it. So tell me about your setup as far as draw weight and arrows and broadheads and all that good stuff for the guys that are kind of gear junkies.
Real quick, right back to that trail camera thing. When he came out that initial time and bugled up at the bull that was on the ridge, he stepped right in front of my trail camera.
Oh, no way.
And it sent the email. Of course, none of us are looking at our phones, you know. Yep. But actually, where I was, we had great cell service. I could see a cell tower from where I was. So that happens. We walk up to the bull, you know, and I'm just sitting there, and Matt's wanting to take pictures because the sun's starting to come over, and I'm like, dude, I just want to let me chill.
Yeah.
So I get a text message from my Uncle Danny, the guy that I'd went out and helped him in 2015 on that tag.
Yeah.
And he just sent me a text of that picture of that bull. And he goes, that's a good bull. And I sent him the picture of my bull laying there with my bow. And I said, yes, it is. And he's like, no way. Like,
that is awesome.
That the bull I kill walks in front of my trail camera in that giant country like that, you know?
So,
wow. It was one of the best hunting days of my life for sure. But back to my rig, I shoot one of your coyotes, FXT, I believe. And I had you build me some 50-pound limbs for it. And I was a little concerned, you know, only shooting 50-pound limbs when I ordered that. But I got the limbs for that bow, and I had been shooting 400 axis, you know, spined arrows.
Yeah.
And they were way too weak with a lower poundage limb. And I'm like, wow, that's telling me something. You know, those limbs are popping. Static limbs are popping arrows harder. So I ended up going to a 340, which was good because I wanted to up my weight for elk anyway. So I'm shooting the Easton 340s, and I put 75 grains up front, and then I'm shooting 150 grain. I shoot both a Magnus Stinger and the cutthroats.
Okay.
And both fly great out of that setup, and it's a 60 inch bow. Absolutely love it. I need to send it to you to have it. But it's got a few dings from all the rocks. And
yeah.
Haven't touched up.
I beat mine up pretty good this season as well. Which broadhead did you end up shooting it with?
I ended up shooting him with the Stinger.
Okay.
With the Magnus Stinger. And I mean, the only reason is I just like a bleeder blade.
Yep.
You know, I like to have that bleeder on there. And I don't, you know, where I hit him, it wouldn't have made a difference. Any broadhead was going to smoke him. But there was, you talked about not much of a blood trail. I could see the blood trail from where I shot him all the way to him.
Wow.
And all the way down. There was a carpet of red.
That's all the way love there, it.
You know. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, literally, 10 by where he was standing before he tipped. You know, 10 by 10 area. There wasn't a rock that wasn't covered in red.
Holy cow!
You know, and the broadhead went through that shoulder blade, and the broadhead wasn't bent. It was intact.
Nice. Perfect. Did you get a hole on the far side, or did it stop short of the far side?
It hit the other shoulder.
Okay.
It hit off shoulder.
All right.
So he was, you know, perfectly broadside.
Yeah.
But I was super happy with the kinetic energy, you know, coming out of that bow at 27 yards on a big bull elk like that, you know, busting that shoulder blade and getting through there.
So, yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah. I was just shooting 52 pounds myself. So I didn't have much on you. What was your arrow weight? Do you know?
562 is what they come out to.
All right. Yeah. Mine's 565. So very similar setup. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to change it. Is that what you're shooting for mule deer as far as arrow?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I see no reason to change it. I've played with it a little bit, you know, and I've shot through the chrono and, I can drop arrow weight, you know, 50 grains and it's not enough feet per second to matter.
Right.
So why would I?
Yeah. It's nice and quiet at that weight too.
My bow is so quiet. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can literally hear the arrow in the air in the video more than you can hear my bow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I take it your brother's probably going to be putting something sweet together with the video footage he came up with, huh?
Yeah, they do quite a bit of work for Sitka. So I'm sure there's going to be a short film come of the whole thing at some mm-hmm. point when he slows down a little bit. So yeah. I can't wait to see that. I mean, it's been so busy and hectic since I got home. I haven't really been able to get up to his studio and see all the footage and everything. You know, he's been sending bits and pieces.
Yeah.
But, you know how life gets when you get back home.
Man.
100 mile an hour again,
yeah. So. Yeah. You got to make up for all the time that you're gone. So you're kind of working double, getting paid the penalty for going on vacation. I know that one well.
Yeah. But you know what? We'll take it.
Oh, 100%.
So the wife, I loaded up three and a half coolers full of meat. I don't know how many pounds of meat. Do you know how many pounds of meat you got off of yours?
I got 349 pounds of boned out meat.
That's insane. That's what I told my brothers. I said, we have well over 300 pounds of meat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and when thank God they were there and my dad was there and my dad's not real big into exercise, but he did really well. I mean, we told him he's 57 years old. I said, you take your time. We're up here. We called him and said, we killed one. And he's like, no way. And I said, just bring that smaller Sitka pack and get a couple more game bags. I said, take your time. It's about 2.5 miles. And he hiked up and we waited. I didn't even start breaking the bull down until he got there. Cause I wanted to take pictures with him too, you know,
right on.
And did that whole deal. And honestly, we had, you know, once we got busy, I think it was less than 2 hours. We had everything boned out in bags and ready to go. Dad awesome. Didn't carry a lot of meat down, but I was sure thankful that he took some because if he wasn't carrying it, we were going to have to, and we wanted to get it out one trip. My brothers, oh man, I don't know how much meat they had, but they each carried a rear and a front.
Oh, dang.
Uh-huh.
My hind quarters looked like they came off a moose. I mean, they're ginormous.
Any idea how old your bull was?
We figured, I mean, I don't, but I mean, we just guessed him at probably 5 years. Maybe he's older than that. I don't know. But body.
I was thinking, yeah, your bull is about similar to mine. We were thinking 5 or 6 years old,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that, like you said, the bodies are giant.
Oh my goodness.
So what do those bulls weigh live weight?
We figured it was 900 to 1,000 pounds.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I've been telling everybody 800. I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. how do you know?
Well, from what I understand, you'll typically yield about 30-35% meat off of, and maybe I'm off on that a bit, but based on that, you know, if we got 1/3 of it was meat, then you're looking at 1,050 pounds. We weighed it all on a scale because I had brought my scale for weighing my llama panniers down there. So we weighed every single game bag and added it up, and it was 349 pounds.
Oh man, So it was almost four coolers.
Mm-hmm.
I had everything loaded last night, and she took to the processor today.
Yeah, I got three coolers out of mine, and I can't remember the sizes on them, but there were two Yetis and another one from Shields that was another good size one. And I actually had to borrow one from Corey because I brought two coolers, and I figured, man, I'm covered, right? Wrong. Yeah, it was unreal. Yeah. And I spent 7 days cutting elk meat, you know, every night after work and on the weekend all days. And I've made a bunch of snack sticks out of it already. And then I just had some backstrap I put on the smoker tonight. And, oh, man, I tell you that there's such a difference in tenderness between, for at least on my bull, between the backstrap and the rest of the meat. I mean, the backstrap is like you could darn near cut it with a butter knife. And the other meat I was having to chew on quite a bit.
Yeah. We eat a lot of burgers. So I'm thinking, you know, we're going to. I told him to give me a couple roasts, but besides the back straps and the loins, I said, I want burger. I mean, we eat burger every night and I'm almost out of deer meat. I mean, we don't hardly eat beef. We eat deer. And that's what the wife, another, you know, nice little pressure. She said, don't you come home without elk meat.
Right. I was like,
thanks, honey.
My wife had no faith I was bringing home an elk. So she had already actually given me the thumbs up for a Texas whitetail doe hunt because she just knew I wasn't going to get an elk. So I came home with 350 pounds of meat. And she's like, you probably didn't need to go on that whitetail hunt. It was pretty funny.
Yeah. I was super paranoid as hot as it was getting during the day about the meat. And, by the time, you know, here's an old trapper cabin where we were staying and, there isn't much of a roof, but they do have a tarp on it and it stays pretty cool during the day. I mean, it wouldn't make it to probably low 60s in that trapper cabin. So we had everything hanging in game bags and got it in there. And I was kind of worried about the flies getting on everything, but we never had a problem with that. And then as soon as it started getting dark, I brought all that meat back outside and opened it all, got it where it air out. And it was nice and cool that next morning. And, I was able to take all my brothers and dad, back to the truck and they took the meat home for me. So I could stay and help my buddy hunt a couple more days and take care of camp, and they got it in the freezer and it was that made me feel a lot better.
When good
Dad
deal.
Sent me that text, that thing was in the deep freeze. So
nice. Did
great trip, man. It went down and what's awesome is my littlest brother, he has one less point than I did. So he, very possible he'll draw this same tag next year.
Oh,
so,
sweet.
What better scouting did we have?
Yeah, this yeah, year, absolutely.
And then, going after it. So, killing him with the stick bow, put the icing on the cake. I know I was getting some pretty dirty looks, Scott, my littlest brother, he's a stick bow hunter too. He kind of bounces back and forth. My other brother, Matt, he's not, he does, he's so busy with his work and filming, he loves the bow hunt, but he doesn't have time to dedicate to the stick bow. And he's like, this is 10 times harder than it should be. And I said, I agree. I 100% agree.
Too funny.
And he's supportive of it. He really is. But, he was sticking it out with me, he wasn't going to leave us. And I was just so thankful when I arrow hit that mark.
What a sick feeling it would have been to see that thing sail over its back. Huh?
I don't even want to go there. But it's South. It's amazing to me what does my coyote weigh? It can't weigh a pound and a half without the quiver on it. So something like that can put down an animal that big.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
it's pretty unreal when all the stars align and everything comes together. Cause it's certainly, there's so many times when the littlest thing prevents you from closing the deal. And then to have it all come together. And it's like the contrast between those, those minutes before the encounter when you're still in hunt mode and you're still like dealing with the last, you know, week or whatever, however many days it's been of all the frustration and all the anxiety and all the exhaustion and all that, that leads up to that moment when you have that encounter, and then you contrast all of that with the feelings immediately after the recovery and the elation, the relief, all of that, the feeling of accomplishment. I mean, how much different, you know, life feels like contrasting those two, those two different sets of emotions and experiences.
Yeah, it's a roller coaster, isn't it? And stick bow hunters got to be the most optimistic people in the world. They have to be, or they wouldn't do it, you know? And, mm-hmm. and when all that all went down, and I mean, absolutely the greatest feeling in the world. And I knew it was a gift from God. I'm like, nothing else can explain how that just happened like that, you know, other than us just being stubborn and keep going, you know. But, you know, and I went out, you know, we did the high country shoot, and we shot with Scott, you know, Hargrove. And, yep. And that last day I shot, you know, with him for a couple hours. And I think that was the single biggest confidence boost for me. And I needed that. You know, I shot with him all day, and then he said, you got this. You know, he knew about the tag, mm-hmm. you know, we had gone to the app. He said, dude, you ain't got nothing to worry about. He said, you can do it. And that was, I needed that, you know, yeah. Somebody like that experience, yep. you know, in my mind, he's a living legend, you know, and,
yep.
and, that was big. And I sent him, you know, the picture that I sent you that morning. I think I sent it to him right after I sent it to you, and, mm-hmm. and he was super excited and congratulated me, you know, and, things like that. It's a tight community, you know, yeah. there's just not a lot of people that do it that way.
Right. So, right. Yeah, no, it is awesome. And man, I'll tell you, it's to have when I, you know, I've shot quite a few mule deer, and you bring home on the average about 65 pounds of boned out meat off of a mule deer. And it's like that stuff is, you know, you watch it like disappear before your very eyes. And my freezer, in both my downstairs refrigerator and then I've got like a full size refrigerator and then then another full size freezer. They sit side by side in my kitchen, and you open the door to that freezer and it is floor to ceiling, front to back, packed with white packages. And man, I just open that thing up and I stare at it and I feel like the wealthiest man in the world. It is so awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You know, and that, I mean, there was several bull moose up there where we were too,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we see them in the middle of the day. And one day we called one of them in, you know, just right. playing with him. And yeah, he 30 yards, man. He got 30 yards from me.
Holy
and I was
cow.
Like, oh my God. You know, I mean, what would you do if you killed that thing up here?
Yeah.
An elk is bad enough. And
right.
that thing's got to be twice as big.
Yeah, they're huge.
But yeah, that bull I'm talking about, he got that close, and I picked up my binoculars and I was looking at him, and he has a big hole in his left ear, like a perfect round hole.
Hmm.
And I'm like, I bet that sucker was tagged when he was a calf. And I looked at my brother, and he got some really good pictures and footage of him, and just as black, you know, mm-hmm. I shoot instinctive. I don't use my arrow at all. So I have to pick a hair spot.
Yeah.
And I couldn't pick a hair on him. He was so black. There yeah. wasn't an off hair or anything. I'm like, God, that'd be hard, you know, uh-huh. to really dial in on a spot on him. But that was pretty neat.
Yeah.
You know, to be that close. He got 30 yards, and I'm like, yeah, it's close enough. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need to come any closer.
Did you guys see any bears up there?
Not one.
Yeah.
Never
did
saw,
I.
Never saw scat or any sign. I think it was too dry.
Yeah.
There's no berries up there, no yep. acorns, you know. So in 2015 in the parking lot, there was bears there, and they destroyed everything we had.
Oh,
trucks,
no.
Gas cans, Yeah.
Holy cow.
So I know there's a bunch of bears in that area. I just think they were lower.
Right. That makes sense.
I did get a couple pictures of bears, you know, earlier weeks before that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was kind of worried about my cameras, you know, because the way them stinking things are, if they see it, they're going to destroy it. And I got pictures. I had two cameras and 2 days apart. I'm pretty sure I got pictures of the same bear. But that was it.
Yeah. Yeah, I missed out on getting a bear tag, and I just knew that I was going to be covered up in them. And of course, you know, when you don't have a bear tag, and fortunately it didn't work out that way, because I would have been super bummed if I had an opportunity to shoot one and not been able to.
My buddy Phil had a bear tag, and you know, you get up there in the mix and you're in your 6 miles backpacked in. And I told Phil, I said, I'm glad I don't have a bear tag, because if I shoot a bear clear back in here, I got to take it all the way down and go get it checked. I mean, you're talking a day and a half to 2 days at a time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And but if a big giant bear walked by, you'd been probably regretted it, but
mm-hmm. Yeah,
but just dealing with it on a special hunt like that, when you've waited that long for that elk tag, you know?
Yeah. You don't want any distractions.
Right.
Yep. Right. So did Phil rather end up getting any opportunities?
Phil had numerous opportunities, never got to shoot an arrow. He was absolutely snake bit.
Oh man.
He was within 15 yards, I want to say 3 times, of bulls over 320.
Holy cow.
And yep. And the last, I left him Wednesday night. So he had Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday to hunt.
Uh-huh.
And he had, from that time that I left. Okay. So he had 3 opportunities from the time I left till Sunday.
Holy cow.
The last one, he had moved locations. The last one he told me it was probably 340 bull at 10 yards and a calf was in front of him and he could not get a shot.
Oh my goodness.
And I felt so sorry for him. I mean, what do you say to a guy to cheer him up when mm-hmm. he put on 145 miles?
Holy cow.
Yeah, I know your phone keeps track of all that, and he added it up.
Wow.
He was, you know, he's 10 years older than I am, and he's, you know, he's tougher than nails, and he was by himself a lot, you know, so he didn't have a camera crew with him.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, it's just... He deserved an opportunity, but who do you talk to about that?
Right. Yep.
But he, you know, he didn't have to wait 15 years for the tag. He's a resident.
Yeah.
That's literally the third time he's had that tag since I've known him.
Oh, so, no kidding.
If there's any consolation, you know,
he'll get it again.
Yeah. He'll get it again. You know, and he committed to hunting with the recurve too. And, he went and took a class with Tom Klum Sr., you know, and went through the whole bit. And, you know, I told Phil, I said, if you're going to be serious about this, you need to go see them guys. And literally Tom changed his life, you know, in one day, as far as shooting a stick bow, he taught
Good
him
deal.
Mechanics and then talked to him on the phone a bunch and sent him videos. And then they worked together and Tom's such a great instructor, such a good teacher,
yeah.
You know, and, I mean, that I can't say enough. I went to one of his classes in January and, huge confidence builder. And he gives you his phone number and he says, anytime, I got my phone all the time. If you got any problems, call me.
Nice.
You know, and that's saying something, you know, not a lot of people will do that.
No question about it. I mean, he has changed so many trad guys, and what they're doing between them and the guys that are the push, the changes that they're making in the industry from a shooting standpoint. And then, you know, the amount of confidence that it's given people. I mean, I have adopted his shooting style. I still haven't been able to wrap my head around Joel Turner's stuff. You know, just shooting the clicker and pulling through and all that. It's, it's made a big difference for me in my shooting as well.
So Joel's helped, and I should have mentioned his name also, but he's helped me a ton too. You know, the class I went to, Joel and Tom were both there.
Sure.
And trying to fit both of what they're trying to teach you in 12 hours is very hard. And right. I told them both that this needs to be a 2-day thing. I mean, my brain was a mess by the time we left that day, but you remember it all. You soak in most of it and you go home and you work with it. And then I have both of their numbers, text them for questions. And Joel's whole deal, and I totally get it. And I, as my bull is coming in, his whole deal is keeping your subconscious out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, if your subconscious, you're human, you're lazy. You know, if your subconscious gets a hold of it, it's going to take every shortcut. You have to go through these steps. And mine's about a 6 or 7 step deal. Did I make it through all 7 steps? No, but I kept my conscious mind there and I knew what I was doing. And I absolutely believe that it, between Tom and Joel, we got it done.
Yeah. So. Awesome. Awesome. Well, good deal, Nick. Hey, I appreciate you coming on here and sharing that story with me. It was pretty neat to be bouncing, you know, back and forth, communicating with you, knowing you're just a few, you know, ridges, a few miles away from me and you know, experiencing similar highs and lows and frustrations and all that. So it was pretty fun to vicariously share that journey.
Yes, it was. It was great. And like I said, you're a huge confidence boost when you send me your pictures of your ball and confidence at that point is what it's all about.
Yep. Well, I'm glad it helped you keep in the game. I felt bad because it was like, oh, finally I'll be able to go over there and might be able to see Nick. And then I go and tag out.
Oh, it floored me, dude. When you sent me that picture, I'm like, I thought he was moving. There's no way he moved. And hey, yeah, man, I appreciate you having me on. It's been great.
Good deal. Good deal. It's good to catch up. So yeah, good luck with the whitetails here coming up over the next few months.
Yeah. We got our work cut out for us. We didn't spend a lot of summer prep. We were concentrated on elk.
Yeah.
That's okay. We'll catch up.
Sure thing. All right, man. So.
Sounds good, Sal. We'll talk to you.
Sure thing. Catch you later.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe and take a few seconds to review the podcast and share it with your friends on your social media platforms. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic or a person you'd like to hear from in a future episode, please email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line. You can further support the podcast by picking up a Western Bowhunter Podcast t-shirt or a window sticker from the Stalker store at stalkerstickbows.com. Thanks for your support.
Too many years have passed me by. I come down.